Chapter 11. Obedience. Never absent from your post, never off guard, never ill-humored, never unready to work for God, is obedience. Mary Baker Eddy. 1892. Reverend Norcross was a kindly minister. And when the water seemed stormy, he began calling upon Brother Nixon with pacific intent. However, a lack of understanding of Mrs. Eddy's church, together with Nixon's material logic, resulted in Norcross's being more influenced by Nixon than vice versa. Albeit, no one but the leader had any awareness of this situation. In October of 1892, the Mother Church had 91 members. The new editor of the Christian Science Journal, Judge Hanna, wrote 2½ pages for his first issue about the October 5th meeting of the Christian Scientist Association, stating that, quote, "the common verdict was that never had there been a more harmonious meeting," end quote. Septimus J. Hanna. Septimus J. Hanna had been called from his home in Scranton, Pennsylvania, to the position vacated by Julia Field King, and he obeyed this call. In his former home of Leadville, Colorado, he had seen his wife restored to health by reading Science and Health, and after 4 years of studying the textbook, had abandoned his legal practice for the practice of Christian Science. In the November Journal, his first issue, he stated, "To my co-workers in truth, I was unexpectedly called to take editorial charge of the journal. A sense of duty impelled me to respond to the call. When called by the voice of truth to responsible duty, which we fain would avoid, we may learn a lesson from the allegory of Jonah and the whale. Called to Nineveh, it is not well for us to take ship for Tarshish. Jonah's experience is likely to be ours. It is better for us to remain on the dry land of our own preference than to be spewed thereon. I have had no journalistic experience, neither have most of my predecessors, so that this could not be urged as an excuse. If earnest purpose and conscientious discharge of the onerous duties devolving upon the position shall be of avail, I shall hope for a fair measure of success." It has often been stated that Mrs. Eddy called Judge Hanna to Boston to edit the journal in 1892. But in a letter to Mrs. Nixon, written on the 11th of October in that year, she stated, "I think Judge Hanna is well adapted to his place, but never knew that he was called to it until it was done." Be that as it may, he was well adapted to his new position and was called by Mrs. Eddy to fill many others in ensuing years. At the first quarterly meeting of the Mother Church on Saturday, December 31st, 349 new applicants were admitted to membership. Shortly before the date of that meeting, the man who was to replace William Nixon as publisher of the Christian Science Journal arrived in Boston. Joseph Armstrong. Joseph Armstrong was president of the Armstrong Bank in Irving, Kansas, when his wife was healed by Christian Science in 1886. After studying with Janet Coleman, he and his wife both entered Mrs. Eddy's primary class in November of 1887 and began practicing Christian Science. Before long, Joseph severed his bank connection to devote full time to the practice of Christian Science. It was probably shortly after receiving Nixon's letter of resignation that Mrs. Eddy wrote to the Armstrongs, asking Joseph to come to the Christian Science Publishing Society in Boston as publisher of the journal. The Knapps' home in Roslindale was a center of Christian Science activity, and it was there Joseph Armstrong went on his arrival in Boston on the 27th of December. He spent the night with the Knappses and soon rented a house nearby. Before long, the Armstrongs were occupying Mrs. Eddy's vacant house in Roslindale, across the street from the Knapps. When Mr. Armstrong obeyed the call to go to Boston to serve in Mrs. Eddy's cause, he brought two very capable young men with him. They were James A. Neal and Thomas W. Hatton, both of whom were students of Mrs. Eddy, and both later filled positions of importance. Dr. Foster Eddy had been the greatest help to his mother during all the steps and winding ways which had to be pursued in reorganizing the church. Now the most important position of all fell upon his shoulders, that of publisher of Mrs. Eddy's books, which required him to spend most of his time in Boston. This seems to have been about the point where animal magnetism began nullifying his usefulness to the leader. Despite the notice that had appeared in the October Journal asking applicants to Dr. Eddy's primary class to wait a year longer, a class was formed at Auburn, Maine, which he was scheduled to teach in December. When Mrs. Eddy heard of it, she said that he must not go and asked Mrs. Knapp to teach the class instead. Thus it was that Flavia S. Knapp began teaching Christian Science on the 5th of December in 1892. James F. Gilman. A week before Mrs. Knapp's class convened in Auburn, Maine, an interesting young man from Vermont arrived in Concord. James Gilman described himself as a homeless, wandering, self-taught artist whose native ability and application had enabled him to support himself with his paintings and sketches. In 1884, at the age of 35, when Christian Science had come into his life, he had immediately embraced it and become a serious student. His intuitive artistic nature, together with his application of Christian Science, brought him, in his own words, quote, late in 1892, into the clear spiritual conviction that wisdom's call now was that he should leave his art practice and, without having a definite material reason, go to Concord, New Hampshire, in obedience solely to his spiritual intuition that it would be spiritually good for him to do so. End quote. Gilman became acquainted with one of the first members of the new church, Mrs. Ann Otis, who was a resident of Concord. And it was she who suggested that he get in touch with Mrs. Eddy's photographer, Mr. Bowers. On the 17th of December, while doing a sketch of the rear of Pleasant View for Mr. Bowers, Gilman got his first glimpse of Mrs. Eddy, dressed in somber black, vigorously walking back and forth the length of the upper veranda. The depth of the black was to him beyond description and seemed sackcloth and ashes. He was so moved by the scene that he wrote the next day to a friend that it seemed to me the founder of Christian Science was thus typifying in outward appearance the inner throes of anguish, perhaps habitually born. Born that the immortal life might appear to humanity as a demonstrated actuality through the vanquishment of material sense with its woes, death included, which were but a nightmare of illusion when rightly understood. Is it by such patient endurance of the woes of sin, not hers, that the world is shown its way to the kingdom of harmony and life eternal, which is thus to become its salvation? It seems to me it is verily so. And this while so many of us who follow are asleep, comparatively. On the 20th of December, Mrs. Otis encouraged Mr. Gilman to go to Pleasant View to see Dr. Eddy, who had just returned from Boston. And during the course of their interview, the doctor brought Mrs. Eddy in to meet the artist. Evidently, reading his thought, Mrs. Eddy laughingly apologized for the strange apparel she had worn on the veranda a few days earlier, to which Gilman replied that he had regarded it as a type of the darkness of materiality with which she was contending. His words made such an impact that she turned immediately away, walking to a window and seeming momentarily on the verge of tears. Gilman's insight was more intuition than understanding, but it was more than Mrs. Eddy had expected from a student. The artistic temperament seems more subject than others to ups and downs, or peaks and troughs, and perhaps accounts for the first question he put to the leader, which was, "Is it not a law of being that we should advance by impulses like the waves of the sea, or like the ebbing and flowing of the tides?" She said that was the way while in our mortal thought, but that in the immortal life, it was all flowing and no ebbing. It was just action, 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 always. At this first visit, with the pleasure of a child, Mrs. Eddy showed him her rooms, the view from her upper veranda, and pointed out in her chamber her bed, quote, "where the sunlight shone the very first thing in the morning," end quote. Gilman recorded the impression and effect of this first meeting. "Her childlikeness impressed me the most, while the magnetic sense of personal presence is so little that it scarcely seemed I was in the presence of anyone who could write Science and Health. This state of things I have been studying on all day since, and this evening I just begin to see that the impressive magnetic sense of presence is not to be looked for in one of high attainments in Christian Science, but just the opposite." Mr. Gilman and Mr. Bowers, who was not a Christian Scientist, were invited to take tea with Mrs. Eddy on New Year's Day, but it was the scientific, spiritually uplifting conversation that so impressed Mr. Gilman, for he called it the New Year's Love Feast. Mrs. Eddy wrote of it as follows to her son the next day. Last Eve, I worked, and the dear Father's presence was with me, and my two guests are sealed for the heaven of soul, and one is snatched from the jaws of the lion. Next time Dr. Eddy, or Benny, as she fondly called him, came to Concord, she mentioned that she would like Mr. Gilman to go through his class so he would be ready for her normal class when she taught it. But she was totally unaware of what Benny was soon to do. About the second week in January, Mr. Gilman received the following note from Mrs. Eddy. Your letter interests me. You seem standing in awe of good and doubting your own reflection of it. But seeing the false assume the reflex shadow, you mentally sketch it as yourself, but it is not. Call on me Thursday Eve at 7 o'clock, and I will talk with you again. Very respectfully, Mary B.G. Eddy. In her next communication to Mr. Gilman, following the Thursday evening meeting, she said, My dear friend, your last letter gave me a sweet sense of your character. I ask a favor of you, which is, keep me informed of your P.O. address. I want you to paint a portrait of me, just such an one as I will describe of other days, or one at this advanced age. I have not decided which. I shall have this done when I get time, and you can do it. But I may never get the time, for my times are in his hands. I want to employ it all in his service and to bless the race. Most truly, Mary B.G. Eddy. Gilman felt it a religious work to do such a portrait well, but he also felt inadequate for the undertaking. However, the leader's words, "You can do it," were such an inspiration to him that he wrote of the project to a friend, quote, "The inspiring quality of her thought suggests beautiful designs, in a vague way as yet, that promise well for success," end quote. About mid-January, the board of directors gave Reverend Norcross a call to be their pastor for another year, but the pastor's first letter showed that he was disinclined to accept the call. When this and further correspondence were sent to Mrs. Eddy, she wrote to Reverend Norcross, Dear student, Mr. Johnson has sent to me your letter of acceptance to remain pastor of the First Church of Christ Scientist in Boston. Your allegations that you base your decision on a knowledge of my desire that you continue with this church are foundationless. You have never asked me for my views on this subject and have no moral right to assume that you know them to be what you declare they are. Since you have stated my mind and I have not expressed it to you and your statement is incorrect, it becomes my duty to say that I do not consider you in the present condition of the church in Boston equal to the responsibility that rests on its pastor. Your sermons have, in several instances, convinced me of this fact, and that your mind has become sadly beclouded. Your faithful, loving teacher, Mary B.G. Eddy. A letter to the board of directors 3 days later informed them of her opinion and action. "Your entire action on calling a pastor to the Church of Christ Scientist in Boston was independent of me, as it should be. Afterwards, in a letter to me, you stated that you had given Mr. Norcross a call to this pastorate for 1 year, and enclosed in your letter his answer, which was not favorable to accepting your call. In this letter, Mr. Norcross declared in substance that he did not feel ready or capable to meet the increasing responsibilities of the situation. Immediately afterwards, you enclosed his letter to me, in which he wrote that he had accepted your call, not because he thought he was equal to the growing responsibilities of the Boston Church, but because he knew that it was my desire that he should accept your call. I immediately wrote to Mr. Norcross that I entertained no such desire, and as I had expressed no such desire, and as I had been unjustly called to this issue, it became my duty to tell him so, and that I agreed with him in his own opinion as to it not being best for him to accept your call and assume the present responsibilities of the situation. During this correspondence by and about the pastor, other things of import were going on in Boston. Shortly before the date of Mrs. Eddy's letter to Reverend Norcross, Mrs. Otis gave Mr. Gilman a message from Dr. Foster Eddy, inviting him to become a member of a class he was about to hold in Boston, with tuition to be paid by artwork at a later date. Gilman's intuition told him not to go, but he was influenced by Mrs. Otis, who thought it a wonderful opportunity. The 23 students who met on the evening of January 25th were cautioned that the holding of this class had not been publicized in order to guard against adverse influence, but they did not know that it was also kept secret from the leader. Mrs. Eddy was extremely sensitive to everything that transpired in her church and in the movement of Christian Science, and when things were not right, she often suffered physically until the correction was made. It is not surprising that she experienced acute physical pain the evening of January 25th, but it was a few days later before she learned about the class. Without knowing specifically of the clandestine disobedience of her son, she must have felt it in the movement, for her message to the CSA on the 1st of February was on obedience. Beloved students, this question nearest my heart is uppermost. Are you filling the measures of life's music with all the sweet tones and exact which you have been taught as the harmony of Christian Science, tones from which I catch the echo of your lives? Obedience alone demonstrates the divine principle which we profess to understand and love. Until the student of Christian Science separates the tares from the wheat, discerns between the thought, motive, and act superinduced by evil minds, and the true God-given intent and volition, and arrests the former and obeys the latter, he is not on the safe side of practice. Obedience is the offspring of love, and love is the principle of unity, the basis of all right thinking and acting. It is difficult for me to carry out a divine commission while participating in the movements or modus operandi of students. To point out every step and watch until it is taken consumes time, and experiment or mistake is costly. According to my calendar, God's time and mortals differ. The neophyte is inclined to be too fast or too slow. He works somewhat in the dark, and out of season would put oil in his lamp. God is the fountain of light, and he illumines our way in obedience. The disobedient make their moves before God makes his, or too late to follow him. We cannot obey both God and a false human sense, false mental suggestions, mistaken motives, and human policy. All these must be stilled for faith to find a resting place and scientific understanding to guide man. Honesty is the indispensable condition of obedience. Insubordination in little things to the law of love and strict obedience thereto test or discriminate between the unreal and the real scientist. The professors of Christian Science must take off their shoes at the threshold of this science, for it is holy ground. They must obey implicitly each and every injunction in the divine principle of life's long problem, or repeat their demonstration in tears. Dr. Foster Eddy presided at the meeting of the association on February 1st, the day after his class concluded. But it was William B. Johnson who read Mrs. Eddy's address to the students. And it was Laura Sargent who brought the news of the doctor's class back from this meeting to Pleasant View. Mrs. Eddy had been grooming Benny, hoping to make him the one teacher of Christian Science who would approximate her teaching, and she knew he was not yet ready for the position. The words she had just penned, quote, "the disobedient make their moves before God makes his," end quote, could not be disregarded. A week or two later, she called Mr. Gilman to Pleasant View to question him about the class or to redeem him from the teaching. Instead of the spiritually receptive thought she had seen before, she found his thought glamored by the expectation of material success. She sent him home with a copy of Pond and Purpose to study and asked him to return the next morning. Her first question to him on the following day was, quote, "Mr. Gilman, do you feel an added sense of consecration since you have been through the class?" End quote. Despite his desire to defend the doctor and his recently acquired superficial eloquence, he answered truly that he did not. During this interview on Sunday, February 12th, he felt that he saw the real Mrs. Eddy for the first time and wrote of this. "I trust I may never forget that vision of God. It made me feel that I had but one purpose in life, and that to labor to bring this realization of the Beloved One to the understanding of mankind. I asked her if there was not something I could do to relieve her of some of the burden she felt. Immediately she answered, quote, "Yes, 3 times daily, seek consecration to Christ's work," end quote, which I promised I would do. Perhaps Mrs. Eddy had seen the picture clearly before, but Mr. Gilman verified her fears regarding the doctor. His granting degrees and admission to her college association may have been what Mrs. Eddy had hoped and planned for his future, but his premature actions had shattered her hopes. Another sentence from her recent address on obedience stated, quote, "However keenly the human affections yearn to forgive a mistake and pass a friend over it, sympathy can neither atone for error, advance individual growth, nor change this immortal decree of love. Be ye perfect," end quote. Her heart yearned for the son she thought she had found in Dr. Foster, but she now knew he would never be the teacher she had envisioned. Gilman, on the other hand, once again, came forth with more than she expected. He wrote a letter to the doctor calling him sharply to account in a way that accorded with his class instruction, while not mentioning Mrs. Eddy. He fully followed the injunction that so few seem able to follow, that of telling a friend of his mistake. Though he was frank and forthright, he also put much love into the letter. Then he sent it unsealed to Mrs. Eddy, suggesting that she post it if she thought it would be helpful. Her response was, "My very dear friend, your letter strikes home, but with Christian intent, and I believe will do my son good. Oh, what a spirit of love impelled it. This is Christian kindness, brotherly love. I thank you, my brother. May God bless your purpose. My son was here since you were. He had an excuse, which I will name to you. With gratitude, Mother." There is no doubt that Dr. Foster Eddy was a fine man, but he had not grown to the importance of the position he was occupying. Consequently, it was more than he could handle. His mother was not the only one beginning to see how animal magnetism was affecting him. William Dana Orcutt, who was in the employ of her printer, John Wilson, had this to say. When Mrs. Eddy removed Mr. Nixon from his position as publisher in January 1893, we at the University Press were prepared to give his successor, Dr. E. J. Foster Eddy, a cordial welcome. But again, a disappointment. I shall never forget the first time I saw him. He arrived at the University Press in a cab, which he had wait for him. This in itself was sensational, for our other clients, including Mrs. Eddy, made use of the less luxurious horse cars from Scully Square. He was immaculately dressed, the climax being his magnificent fur-lined coat, fur cap, and the stunning diamond in his shirt front. We found in him an agreeable personality, with a gratifying willingness to accept suggestions and make promises to cooperate. But there it stopped. Over and over again, we had to refer details direct to Mrs. Eddy, because Dr. Foster Eddy was not at his office and could not be located. Mrs. Eddy left the doctor in his position as publisher of her books and asked the Knapp family if he could live with them, which he did for about a year. Mrs. Eddy wrote Mr. Knapp when requesting a monthly billing, quote, "I hope the atmosphere at your house and this retreating from the fire at the Fort of God will be blessed to him," end quote. But she also inserted the following notice in the very front of the March journal. Notice: since the last meeting of the alumni of the CSA of my college, I am pressed with inquiries as to the eligibility of my students' pupils to become members of the above-named society. The CSA of the Massachusetts Metaphysical College is my association. I organized it, framed its constitution and bylaws, and was president of this association. The present meetings of this society are informal, simply the gathering together of the alumni of the college. A person cannot be made constitutionally a member of the CSA of my college unless I have endorsed his application for membership, nor can he legally receive the degrees of the Massachusetts Metaphysical College unless conferred by its president on her students. Mrs. Mary W. Monroe, 281 Columbus Avenue, Boston, the treasurer pro tem of the CSA, will return all dues, except from honorary members, sent in for membership subsequent to the disorganization of the CSA. Dr. Foster Eddy can form an organization for his students and thus suitably care for his flock. Mary B.G. Eddy. Despite the steps she had to take, the mother heart still yearned. In revising her Voices of Spring, she added, "Did you thank God for that redemptive strain from life which taught you the Lord's Prayer, and for that mother's silent orison breathing thus, 'O gentle presence, peace and joy and power, O life divine that owns each waiting hour, thou love that guards the nestling's faltering flight, keep thou my child on upward wing tonight.'"